This episode was recorded for my UK Column show. Please support UK Column by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Simon Elmer. My background is in art history. I trained. I got a doctorate in the history of art. So I'm probably one of those terrible teachers who made you hate art so much. But I haven't written. I've written very little about art and culture over the last 5 years because I was too busy writing about lockdown and analysing data on infection fatality rates and then looking at the various motivations before the for the proxy war in the Ukraine and then analysing why. I don't know, something like, you know, suddenly the whole world seems to be so interested in the rights of transvestites and all that sort of stuff. But my background is definitely in kind of art and cultural studies. And over the last 10 years, I kind of permit myself to occasionally go off on a tangent and write about something. And recently, I put together this book of articles over the last 10 years called Culture Wars. And it came out of... I guess my thoughts about the increasing and expanded role of culture in what's going on, particularly in the West, and my observations about the death of art. Because like you, I mean, you're a political cartoonist, aren't you? I sort of came to the realization, it was partly, I think, because I've moved to China, I'm living in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong doesn't really have a living culture, in my opinion, outside of its restaurants and its food. It celebrates its very ancient culture of China, but it doesn't really have what we would call in the West a living culture. But I think it reminded me how much I miss contemporary art, or I miss a living culture. And I think, like all of us, we've come to wonder what's happened to art in the West. You know, I used to live in the UK for most of my life, and I think art doesn't exist in the UK anymore. It's been replaced by something else. And I think now that I think like a lot of young people, I had a low opinion of art growing up, even though I was studying it as a historian of art. I thought it was, it became too obscure for people to appreciate. It kind of retired into a very elitist kind of audience. It very quickly became co-opted by the corporate world, who kind of, you know, paid these enormous prices for it and therefore controlled who got selected to be an artist and who didn't. Who went into the museum sector and so on and so forth, the gallery sector. So I didn't really have much... I was very critical of the role that contemporary art practice had in the wider culture of the West. But now that it doesn't have any role whatsoever, in a way, it doesn't have a role as a space of art, a space of expression, of debate, of where people can meet and discuss ideas, which it did in the UK in the 90s. Whatever you think about what was called then the Young British Artists, it definitely created a debate. Every weekend, you know, there were debates around what culture is, what art was, what society was, what community was, what was going on in the world that happened within a context that you could call artistic. And that's all gone now. That's completely gone. And now that it has gone, I've suddenly realized, probably too late, the importance of art in a culture. And now that we don't have it, I'm trying to understand what's replaced it and why it has been killed so completely.
You're going to shoot me for this question. Simon, what is art?
What is art? Oh, gosh. Art is... well, the easy answer to that is art is whatever people say it is, isn't it? Conceptual art's got a lot to answer for. You know, I often go into galleries now and I could have turned to my girlfriend and sort of say, yeah, conceptual art's got a lot to answer for. I'll tell you what art is. Art is, it's kind of what I kind of conclude in the preface to this book, which I wrote, I published this June and I wrote the preface this year. So the articles go back 10 years, but I wrote now kind of reflecting on it. I think art and community are interdependent. And when one dies, the other dies. I think what's going on in the world now is the destruction of community, of national communities, of local communities, indigenous communities. And one of the ways that's done, I think, is by destroying their art. I think communities form around art, even though they might not know it or think of it in that way. But I think they do. Maybe culture is a better word. Definitely. I think culture, in the expanded sense, means much more than what we call the arts, you know, the different types of arts. It's about the way that people live together, the way that they pass on their values and their histories to the next generation, the way they interact with each other, the way they manage to sit down to eat together or meet together or play together, or even work together without killing each other or stabbing each other or attacking each other. That's kind of what culture is. It's a historical thing. And within that, there's something called art, which is not only, I think, although it's become that way in the 20th century, a specialist practice of professionals. You know, I happen to believe that there's a very, very small percentage of the population who could call themselves poets, for instance, which is a very dead art at the moment. But, or musicians, or yeah, all of it really now. And yet, I think all of us recognize the importance of music in our lives or poetry in our lives. You know, in moments of great stress or of happiness, we often turn to poetry. I think a lot of people write poetry. They don't write very good poetry. That probably includes myself. I write poetry. I write more and more of it as I get older. It doesn't matter whether it's necessarily good. It's something in us. And I think part of the death of art and what it's been replaced with is about killing our cultures and our sense of what binds us to each other as part of something more than an individual, as a family, as a community, as a town, as a nation, as a civilization. All that's been under attack. And I think that is why the death of art, which after all has been proclaimed mostly by artists for, you know, over a century now, it really, I think they, when they proclaimed it, they wanted art to be superseded by something else, something which was better, something which wasn't so elite. Actually, the opposite has happened. Art has been replaced by something which has got nothing to do with art. And that is, of course, I think, propaganda. And a lot of my book is about what I think is the condition and the result of the death of art. That is, it has killed art, but it is on the death of art that this has emerged as the dominant culture of our Western civilization. And that is woke. Woke is now the dominant ideology of our culture. Woke has many, many strands. It is the official ideology of what is now being called stakeholder capitalism. And I think it can only have acquired that space, appropriated that space, by killing art and turning all culture now into propaganda for woke.
I mean, art is, it's critical. It's a critical component of the human condition. It's always been part of humanity. If you go back to cave art, it was a form of communication. Isn't it also essentially a form of creation, of creativity? It's the ability to create.
Yeah. I was in the south of France a few years ago, and I went to, you can't actually see the cave. It's the Chauvet Cave, which is in the south of France. Everyone thought that the oldest cave art was kind of Lascaux, sort of 16,000 years ago. Chauvet kind of doubled that. It's kind of incredible. And the French, as they do, they kind of recreated what the cave looks like. So you can actually walk around and see it. And it's incredible. And that's 34,000 years ago. So art is coextensive with the emergence of what we now call Homo sapien, of modern man, if you like. It's part of us. It's a bit like when you get these strange ideologies which like want to stop people drinking alcohol, or they want to stop people dancing, or they want to stop people doing all sorts of things that we've been doing for hundreds of thousands of years, or thousands and thousands of years. These are things which are part of us, for good or bad, in the human condition. And, you know, as we've talked about before in different shows, part of what's going on at the moment, I think, is moving into a kind of a post-human world, in which everything that makes us human, which is above all our relationship to each other, humans are very social animals, has to be destroyed. When we can't come together to talk to each other, to express each other, to see what the most talented or interesting or critical or simply new people in our society who call themselves artists have got to tell us about the world, whether we agree with it or not, you lose a very important part of the public square, I think. And woke could only achieve I guess, you know, I mentioned two things that kind of started me thinking about this. The other one is, I think we're living at the moment, I mean, you know what it's like every day, you kind of open the newspaper or go online. There's a kind of, the things that people believe at the moment, and whether they believe it because they are forced to believe it, that is, they don't implicitly, or they actually do believe. And I think there's a whole range of people out there in the West who do believe the precepts, the principles of woke and the dogma of woke. Because woke, I think, is a very much a religious movement. I think it's a kind of a neo-Puritan movement of reformation. You know, it comes out of America, which is kind of a Puritan kind of place. The sheer lunacy, I would say even almost insanity, because not to dismiss it as a phobia. You know, when people say Islamophobia, they say, well, you know, you don't have a rational opposition to Islam or something like that. They just mean that you are having an irrational response to it. So I don't want to say that they're irrational. But the basis of woke as an ideology is that you cannot debate it. If you do, if you say, well, actually, just because a man says he's a woman, he isn't a woman, they say, well, you're endangering of the life of people who identify as transvestites or transsexuals. If you say that I don't actually think that COVID was a disease which constituted a pandemic, and I'm not going to wear a mask because masks weren't built to do that. That's not at all what their function is. They say, well, you're endangering my life. So a lot of the principles of woke are that you cannot debate it. It is actually a form of insanity in the sense that the people who defend those principles and believe in them are beyond rational debate. And I've tried to think, you know, I was meeting with a friend here in Hong Kong recently, and he was sort of saying, how's this done in such a short period of time? You know, we're a similar age, and we will remember when, particularly, you know, we both had worked in education, when debate, rational debate, without screaming and shouting and beating people up, was a kind of basis, at least in principle. You may not think that if you'd ever looked at the Houses of Parliament during question time, but at least in principle, these were things that we defended and we recognised as the basis of a civilised society. It's not only now that people don't do that, they don't engage in debate, but they don't see the freedom to debate without being arrested for hate speech or denounced as some form of phobia, or to be attacked, or to be diagnosed, to be diagnosed with some sort of phobia for your views. This is something which now is not something they do because they don't want to or they can't, but because that's actually a principle of woke, not to debate with people, to just say, no, you're sick, and we're going to arrest you if you keep on talking this way. So I've been trying to understand that, and I think to understand the death of art and this new expanded role of culture is one of the keys to understanding how woke has, in such a short period of time, colonized the minds of so many people, not just our children, not just our youth, our university students, but I think most of the political and professional classes of the West. I think they actually believe this stuff, which terrifies the hell out of me, as I'm sure it does you.
Yeah, I mean, and do you think it's by design? I mean, it has to be. I don't remember the term woke in the 90s. I don't remember the term transgender in the 90s.
No, it's a very new term. It's a very new term. I mean, in my book, I kind of trace it back because I'm old enough to remember when multiculturalism kind of entered into the discourse. And multiculturalism actually means monoculturalism. It means the domination of all cultures by, I guess, US consumer culture. I don't think you can confine it to the US now because it has colonized all cultures. It was the opposite of what it does. But then it was followed by things like political correctness, which is, it started off as a way, I guess it came out of that fascination with language which we had in the 80s and 90s and before that in the 70s, came out of movements like structuralism, and then it became a form of policing speech. Then you had the rise of identity politics, which kind of superseded it. Sort of that came in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, and feminism in parallel.
Feminism as well, which has now been turned into kind of the opposite of feminism. You know, what was good about feminism has now become everything that was bad about it, if you like. This kind of relentless attack on masculinity and young men who've been told, I mean, I don't think there's a man under 40 in England now who hasn't been told since he was born that he is bad, that everything about
him toxic.
And toxic masculinity, phrases like this. You know, at the moment in England, the not a day goes by without someone being attacked, some woman being attacked. And they're finding out that if you emasculate an entire generation of men, you are open to attack by this vast influx of immigrants who are coming in from places who've got very different ideas about the relationship between men and women than we have. So to go back to your point, woke is a very new term. I mean, how old is it? Maybe 5-10 years? But its progenitors, identity politics, multiculturalism, political correctness, and then other academic subjects like post-colonialism, which started off as a good thing, but then it sort of turned into things like critical race theory, which decides that all white people are, from the moment they're born to the moment they're dead, guilty of white privilege.
Didn't that develop in the 80s, critical race theory, or just critical theory?
Critical theory definitely became very big in the 80s. Mm. And that itself, I mean, I kind of probably studied something which had been called that. You know, that was the big word. You know, we've raised a generation of children, or two generations now, who have kind of worshipped at the altar of critical theory. Mm. But critical theory has turned into the kind of the braying repetition of the dogma of woke.
Yeah, postmodernism.
Postmodernism, if you like. Yeah, that's another thing where everything becomes a relative value. One of the principles, I think, of woke is that very postmodern idea that that the world, our perception of the world, is constructed by mass media, by culture, by dominant narratives. What do they used to call them? Master narratives and things like this. And there is an element of truth in that, obviously. You know, there's so much debate now. Every time anything happens in the world, we go, so what to extent are we seeing it as it happened, or is it how? What to extent is it mediated? And, you know, I've got a lot of time for that, to be suspicious of the way the world is created around us. Never more so than now. I mean, you know, what we lived through in the last 5 years. But unfortunately, it's kind of got it to the point where if the principles of woke, using this umbrella term, whether that's environmental fundamentalism, transgenderism, the proxy war in the Ukraine, all these things, if they are contradicted by reality, someone actually finds that CO2 is not the measure of global warming or climate change, or they find that actually, you know, what we've been told about the proxy war in Russia didn't begin in February 2022, but actually began in 2014, and it came out of a coup organized by blah, blah, blah. Or we find out that actually men or women cannot change sex, all these sort of basic points. Or we find out that actually the UK or the West hasn't always been nations of immigrants, but actually immigration has been very much a post-war thing and it's increased massively and it's a direct program of, you know, replacement immigration, which is a UN policy. If you come up with all these facts, woke simply says, well, these facts are racist, transphobic, sexist, climate denialists, Putin apologists. There's a series of pathologizations, that was the word I was looking about, where anyone who doesn't agree with these principles of woke is then simply dismissed. And if they can persist, they are then, first of all, their careers are ruined, and then they are censored, and eventually, if they persist even further, they get arrested. So, strangely, out of postmodernism's, if that's a very broad term, critique of the role of ideology, if you like, in the bigger sense of the term, in mediating our perception and experience of the world, has come a complete denial of the reality of the world. Now there is not a doctor in England, there's not a politician, there's not a teacher, there's not a university lecturer, there's not a counsellor who won't agree with all these quite obviously incorrect statements that men can change, that men can change sex, that masks built to stop saliva from a surgeon operating on a patient can somehow stop particles from an airborne virus. All these things which are, you know, kind of the basis of our society to distinguish between fact and fiction, between what has been scientifically proven, if you like, and what has been still speculation, between what we know to have happened in the past and what we're told about it. These are kind of the basis of a rational society. And woke has created a culture that allows or has required the people who kind of run our society to be able to deny these en masse. And that's a very dangerous place to be, I think.
It's a very dangerous place because it also manifests itself in my own work as a political cartoonist. And I was saying to you earlier how much I hated studying art. And I can't tell you precisely why I hated studying art, but it just felt shallow and completely empty and rudderless. And I think that feeds into what you're saying, that, you know, quote unquote, art is dead. Long live art. And political cartooning has never really been considered art anyway. It's like the dregs. It's the bottom of the hierarchy. You know, we have an idea and we draw really badly and try and get a message out there. When you mentioned earlier how artists become commodified, I immediately thought of Andy Warhol and Jackson Pollock.
I mean, Warhol was probably the first art, well, not the first, but he was the artist who kind of embraced his own commodification, didn't he? I think he understood so much about, you know, his famous statement that everyone will be famous for 15 minutes in the future has obviously come true for quite some time now. And he embraced that commodification. I mean, just to go back to what you said about political cartoons, in the UK, cartoonists, and that whole area of political satire, if you like, is used to have a very important part for a long time in the UK. You know, I've always used to say the British, we don't do revolution and we don't do philosophy. We leave that for the French and the Germans. But we do do political satire.
There's some great, I'm interrupting, but there was some great British satire in the 80s. I'm thinking, what was that show with the puppets?
Spitting Image.
It was fantastic.
And before that, we had things like Yes Minister, which kind of dove into it was a great, you know, a lot of my political education as a young man came from watching things like Yes Minister, or after that, watching Rory Bremner, who used to do impressions, who was a great political analyst as well as a kind of comedian. The British, we don't like to listen to kind of a serious political show too much, but we'll listen to someone taking the mickey out of a politician, and in doing so, exposing something about the political process. I miss those a lot, and I still remember, you know, not the 9 o'clock news. It's kind of ingrained. It used to be ingrained in that generation.
Even Python,
Pythons as well. I mean, it goes back to Gilray and Rawlinson and stuff. You know, in the early 19th century, we got a long tradition of that. That's all gone now. What has happened to the role of the artist? Because the artist hasn't got away. There's probably more artists than ever at the moment. But their role. I mean, one of the things I write about in this preface is what role artists have assumed now in this new expanded field of culture under stakeholder capitalism. And I think part of what neoliberalism did is it brought the production and dissemination and publication of art, all art, and the practice of it, within the purview and the control of the private sector. Yeah. So galleries, museums, and so on and so forth, getting on to if you're a filmmaker or if you're a comedian, to get into these venues where you could actually make a living from it, or at least, you know, disseminate your work, was completely taken over by the private sector. That's what neoliberalism did with all sorts of areas of public life. And now it has complete control over it. That doesn't mean it now only simply controls the political statements of those artists, or controls whether they share their work or publicise their work, which it has done for a long time, certainly in this country. It now means that if you want to be an artist in the UK of any kind, if you want to work in the culture industry, I've got a number of friends who, they're not artists per se, they're certainly not professional artists, but they work in galleries, they work in museums, and so on and so forth. You have to, if you're an artist, you have to adopt and express the values of woke, the principles of woke, the dogma of woke. If you work in the galleries, and I think this extends into lots of industries actually, you have to go through woke indoctrination programs like unconscious bias training, white privilege. You know, I've got friends who have to go through all this. And for someone of my generation, that's utterly insane. It's like they've decided that there's some sort of official, or not some sort of, that there is an official ideology of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And that ideology is woke. And if you don't believe it, or at least you don't act according to its principles, which they present as simply being, you know, respectful of people's human rights and all that sort of stuff. It's nothing of the kind. You will not work. You will not get employed. And art, the work of artists and art and this expanded field of culture have adopted this role of giving a sort of a nice face to what are actual dictates of a monoculture, a mono ideology, an official ideology, which is that of work. I've actually stopped watching, except for very occasionally, just to kind of remind myself how bad it is. I keep on saying, you know, my girlfriend says, oh, what do you want to watch tonight? So we watch a British film, and I'm like, not after 1980. You know, sometimes I'll go into 1980s. Like the other day, I watched something from the early 90s. I think it was Kingdom of Heaven. And I was just like, oh, God, I can't watch all this sort of stuff. All culture is, and all art is always going to have elements, more or less, of the basic beliefs and the prejudices of the culture, of the society out of which it comes. Yeah, that's how what culture is. Culture is an expression of a society. And no matter how much individual artists think they're separate from that or critical of it, there's always going to be an element in it. But that's changed now. They're not simply influenced by it. They're not even critical of it. They are now the voice through which power speaks to the members of a society. And there is no artist that I know of with any kind of public profile in the UK, whether that's a comedian or an architect or a writer or a poet or a filmmaker or an actor or a theatre production team or any of the others, a painter or whatever, who is not now a voice for the principles of work. There may be individual artists who do that. There's always going to be people who escape that, but they will not get the shows, they will not get the backing, they will not get the public, there are the government grants, they won't get the public sector sponsorships, they won't get any of that. In other words, they'll struggle as someone who is not a professional artist. They'll try to get by somehow. But if you want to be a professional artist, artists, I think for quite some time now, but it's really increased since lockdown, I think, and this move into stakeholder capitalism, they've really embraced their new role as the mouthpieces of power. And I think that's pretty disgraceful.
You've spoken about stakeholder capitalism a few times. And of course, another way of expressing that same idea is technocracy, which is effectively running society through science and technology. And it's a terrible prospect. I'm reminded of that quip, but is it art? And I want to ask you the question, but is AI art?
No, AI is not art. I very much doubt it. AI is not, I don't think, I've got very limited knowledge of AI. From what I can see, AI is not artificial intelligence. It's very complex.
Algorithms
which have been programmed by the makers. I think it's been called artificial intelligence very much in the same way that we have millions, well, not millions, we have lots, dozens and dozens of websites called fact-checked. And they will go on and they will fact-check any statement that anyone makes or any, for instance, social media post, which has, you know, received a million shares or views, or any event that happens, and it will say, we have checked this and we have debunked the truth of this. And people who subscribe to those websites can then say, I mean, I've had it to myself a lot, you know, I'm having a discussion, people say, oh, but that's been debunked. It's like, by whom? So
it's been discredited. Okay, but
yes,
by
it's
whom?
Been discredited. And it gives them a sense of sort of somehow that there is, I mean, I can understand this. It gives them a sense that there is some sort of objective arbiter of what is true and what is false. And that applies to science, to politics, to history. Now, the people in charge of history is the media. The people in charge of politics are the corporate backers of the policy. The people in charge of science are, as we saw, the pharmaceutical companies and things like that. They are the people who create the websites which say that something is debunked or not. I can understand we've been living in a kind of a postmodern world for quite a while now, haven't we? 45 years or more, 50 years. And one of the celebrated and disseminated principles of postmodernism is that there is no one truth, that truth is a product of discourse. Discourse is a product of institutions who attribute a truth value to a discourse, and therefore they're products of power. And that leaves you in a very scary state. You kind of pick up a newspaper and you sort of go, well, is that true? I hear a president say something. Is that true? I hear a doctor say something. You know, a doctor comes up to something, when someone goes in and she says, I'm terrified because I've been hearing all this stuff on the BBC about anyone can, you know, anyone can have COVID and anyone can share it. What should I do? And the doctor says to you, well, you better inject your kid and wear a face mask all the time and don't leave the home for 6 months. Now, those doctors were lying. And as more and more of the lies, not just of the last 5 years, the Iraq war, you know, whatever you want to go back to, people want to have some sort of authority that they can trust, which will say, this is true, this is debunked. And I think artificial intelligence, to go back to your question, has been called that so that people are encouraged to see this as some sort of objective, transhuman in form of intelligence. Because it is not human, it doesn't have an ideology, it doesn't have a culture, it doesn't have a prejudice, it doesn't have a colour, it doesn't have a race, etc., 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 that somehow this is some sort of objective truth. And we're definitely encouraged to see AI like that. I mean, the amount of time I'm on social media and someone will say to Grok, which I presume is a kind of an AI thing, and say, is this true? And Grok will come back and sort of give an analysis of it and say, well, actually, this is true. All it's doing, all Grok can do, is, as far as I can see, is it's doing a Google search of the data on a particular topic. Now, I do a lot of Google searches on data on particular topics myself. And, you know, recently I was going back and looking up, reviewing statistics, which I'd looked up back in 2016 on the housing crisis in the UK. I do it now, and I would type in what I'd written, and Grok would, or the AI would say, yes, this is true, or blah, blah, blah. And then I would search those references, and many times, it was not true. It was not true. They were simply repeating what I was saying. So if AI is not intelligence, artificial or otherwise, it certainly can't be art. Art is human or it's nothing. And human is social or it's nothing. Human is about, as I said before, the things that bind us and allow us to live with each other. It's about things which machines could never understand, like our mortality, like our love, like our desires, like our fears and our hates. All the things that make us human. And AI cannot make art. Unfortunately, nowadays, you know, you go into a museum and you see things, and or you see it online when people sort of say, oh, this is art. It's not art. But it's no point me saying this is and isn't art. The interesting thing, and the thing that I guess a critic of the history of art and of the transmutations or the changes in art should do, is to understand why art has changed so much. Why is it not what maybe you and I think art is, and what it's become, and why it has become that, and what it's doing now. Because art definitely still exists, but not what we, you and I, understand by art.
Okay, so I asked the question about, is it art? Because somebody sent me a song a few days ago, a friend of mine. He says, what do you think of the song? And I listened to it, and I thought, it's a typical pop song, and sounds good. I said, tell me, do you know the singer? He said, no, none of it's real. Mm. And it just got me thinking, you go into an art gallery and you look at a series of paintings up on the wall. The exhibitors don't tell you that this is all AI produced stuff. Mm. And you walk out there, do you feel cheated?
Yeah, I mean, people have used techniques to write pop songs for a very long time. And before that, Tin Pan Alley or something like that. The people who wrote, you know, the first hit songs, whether that's in the 60s or the 90s or whatever, they were probably almost definitely using a kind of a formula. So using formulas or using technology, you know, architects obviously use enormous amount of technology, increasing number amount of technology to build their buildings. I think there's a problem. I mean, within architecture, there's a kind of a school, if you like, or a movement called parametricism, which is built. If you've seen something like the buildings of Zaha Hadid, you see those sort of buildings which look like, I compare them to sort of blancmanges. They're kind of amazing sort of stuff. Parametricism is a kind of a program which will, you put in what you want to do. I want, what are the parameters of how much I can, you know, expand this wall or do this? And it will calculate how you can do that. And then it will build that building for you, or it will design the building for you. You could use the same thing in writing a song. As I said, AI is merely a highly sophisticated and perhaps dangerous. I don't really know about the dangers of it. It seems that it's got an internal motor, if you like, which goes beyond, I guess, its capacities for learning. I guess because it is a computer which has an enormous memory bank and could initiate, can it initiate? I don't know. I'm kind of the wrong person to talk about this. I guess to go back to the point of art, I don't think the use of technology disqualifies something of being art. I certainly don't think that. I think that would be kind of silly in a way. You know, in the Renaissance, people used all sorts of technology to build these amazing cathedrals and so on, or even before that. So I don't think that's a problem. But that also doesn't mean that, I think the problem perhaps is that we as viewers of art and consumers of art and judges of it, maybe are dazzled by the sophistication of it, the sheen of it, the gloss of it, the spectacle of art. You know, we've both been traveling around China recently. And the cities,
Chinese art's beautiful.
Well, the ancient stuff, yeah. I mean, I love the calligraphy and stuff. But their real contemporary art is the cityscape at night. There's no Chinese city I've been to yet, which doesn't seem to have been built around a view of the skyline at night, which is all lit up and stuff. Now, the Chinese love it. They get out their phones and they kind of photograph it. It's something we know in the West as well. We're becoming more and more like that. Our cities have been turned into kind of images of themselves, I think. Now, I don't think that's art. I don't think it's culture either. I think it's part of the spectacle, in the sense, you know, kind of formulated by Guy Debord in his book, The Society of the Spectacle. It's about, I mean, his definition of the spectacle was an excellent one. It's capital accumulated to the point where it becomes an image. And it's something about the dazzling, I think, of us. Of us dazzling us so much that we don't know how to be critical. You know, nowadays, well, not nowadays, a little while ago, suddenly the biggest thing was 3D cinema. And I went into 3D cinema and put the glasses on, and I found it very, very disturbing. I didn't like it at all because I was inside the image. I couldn't look at it as a frame. It's a similar thing now goes when you go to an exhibition of Van Gogh, or however you say it, they won't have the actual paintings. They'll have slides or videos of them moving and stuff like this. Now, people need to understand, if they're going to appreciate Van Gogh, that he is a painter, and the frame of that painting and the texture of the paint and all that sort of stuff is what makes it a work of art. Projecting it onto a wall with these kind of swirly things, that's not what makes a Van Gogh a wonderful painter, or any other painter as well. And I think the same way, you know, the best films are films in which you have a space between you and the work of art. Of course, within narrative cinema, you go into a dark space, it's all dark, you sit there, you take the popcorn out, or I don't anyway, and you kind of get lost in these characters, you identify with the characters. The identification with characters goes back to ancient Greece. You know, that whole point of catharsis and so on. So it's not a new thing. You lose yourself in it, but you retain a space of perception and criticality, which allows you to reflect upon the work of art. You know, one of the roles of ancient Greek tragedy was for the members of a society, the members of ancient Greece or something, to sit down and think about their own society, think about their relationship to the gods, to fate, to history, to war, all that sort of stuff. The art that we are have been promoting, I think, for some time now, the words that describe it is immersive, tear-jerking, overwhelming, heartwarming. These are not critical terms. These are terms in which you dissolve into the experience. You become part of the experience. And I think part of that is to remove that critical distance that we need not only to the artwork, but to the world in which it exists. When you are weeping, when you are in the work of art, when you are overwhelmed by it, when you are terrified by it, when it's appealing to your base emotions, whether that's anger or whatever, you might have a hell of a time. You might come out going, as people do now, wow, that was incredible. But that is no longer art. That's part of the spectacle. And the spectacle serves to take away our critical faculties. And it takes away that space, which I really enjoy in films. I went to see a film by the Iranian director Panani the other day in Hong Kong. Managed to find a cinema in Hong Kong which has a decent cinema in it. And it wasn't a completely successful film, but for 2.5 hours or whatever it is, I got to think about that film. And those spaces of thought are very, very important. And the spectacle, in the broader sense of the term, are about erasing those spaces, to take away that space of thinking, debate and expression and replace it with the very emotive values of the spectacle.
I laughed now when you struggled with the pronunciation of Van Gogh. So a couple of years ago, I think 2023, my wife and I were in Amsterdam and we had the great privilege of going on a private tour of his museum. Yeah. And the guide... I specifically asked the guide, how do you pronounce his name?
Van Gogh, and she said,
it's Van Gogh. Yeah, Van Gogh. But nobody can say that other than the Dutch, really.
People already know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Americans say Van Gogh.
Van Gogh, yes, because they can't do the kh sound. And so that's precisely what the guide told us. She said, she says Van Gogh or Van Gogh, depending on who her audience or who she's taking around the museum. Because if she says Van Gogh, she says she's had it before where Americans say to her, who are you talking about? Yeah, yeah. I love his artwork and you are absolutely dead right, that you can't be immersed in it. You have to stand back and look at it because of the way he framed it and all that kind of stuff. And that's also largely because he wasn't a very good artist, if we're being very honest about ourselves. He's one of my favorite artists.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think he's one of the greatest. He's certainly not as great as everyone says. He's very important and interesting, I think. Yeah.
Yes, and his story is probably what makes him. But I mean, I don't know if you've been to Versailles and had a look at some of that art. It is spectacular, absolutely exquisite. And then today you have a banana peel stuck on a wall.
This is going to be a critique of contemporary art. Yeah. I guess let's maybe talk about woke a little bit, about what it's trying to do.
100% agreed, yes.
Yeah, because I think the, you know, we're merely talking about changes in art, which have now become, you know, someone could come in and say, oh, you're a couple of elitists. You know, why shouldn't people go and look at Van Gogh being projected on a museum wall or something like that? Or why should we go and have a movie where we come out and we feel, you know, exhilarated because we actually feel that we've been inside it? I don't think what I'm trying to talk about is not just that, because what is replacing art is not simply worse art, if you like, or more popular art, or less highbrow art, or less critical art, for which there is a role for all that sort of stuff, perhaps. We're being presented with something which is trying to, I think, dismantle our civilization. One of the things I write about in the preface to this is I ask the question, why is it now that art has finally been killed? Art as we understand it, as having a critical function, a space of relative freedom, because obviously the culture industry is not necessarily about freedom. You know, we talked about some of the problems in it, but relative freedom in which people can come together and think and speak and debate and express themselves or see other people express themselves about the issues of the day. We've lacked that space for quite some time now. Why has it happened now? The bigger picture, I think, is that European civilization, which goes back round about 1,000 years, if you think about the actual birth of Europe as a polity, if you like, as a civilization, which isn't ancient Rome, which is, you know, but you can take Europe back as far as you want. That, I think, is now, well, it's undeniably under attack. I think one of the principles of my understanding of this is what I said before, that a community and art go together. They exist, they're interdependent, and when one goes, the other goes. I think part of the destruction of Europe and the replacement of its people by this policy of replacement immigration is, you to do that, you have to get rid of the culture of Europe as well. The UK seems to be the most advanced. I don't know, Germany's pretty bad as well, but the UK at the moment seems to have taken a series of very large steps into the erasure of anything which you could call British culture. England, I don't know how much you know about this, I imagine you know a lot, Jeremy, but in England, it must be the only country in the world where you are arrested for flying your own flag by your own police forces, and then you are denounced by the people who have come to the country to live there, presumably to integrate, of course, that's the lie. You're then denounced as a racist for flying your own flag. And then your arrest will be disseminated on all the media platforms and all the news programmes and debated in Parliament. And people will actually say now that if you fly the English flag in England as an English person, you are far right. Now, that's just one example. There's numerous examples. The equivalent of our Orwell's kind of thought police, it's called Prevent UK. It started off as an anti-terrorist surveillance government program, which ostensibly was set up after 7/7, the bombings in London in 7/7, to monitor the threat of Islamic terrorism in the UK. It's actually become quite the opposite of that. It is now defined in its literature, and these are the principles by which our security services and our police are operating, that forms of terrorism now include cultural nationalism. So any celebration of the national culture of England or Britain in general is now considered a form of terrorism. I know this sounds to your listeners, they'll think I'm completely mad. If they get my book, they can look up the website in which it says it. Any opposition to any of the policies by which we're threatened, whether that's mass immigration or the rise of Sharia courts or our simple dislike of women walking around wearing burqas, these are all considered now forms of terrorism. So there's many, many other examples. I won't go into them all, I'll be listing them all. But there is a erasure of British culture. It's hard to say British culture because we're a strange country. We've been divided for so long between Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland and so on and so forth. But if I can use this umbrella term, British culture, that is being systematically erased. And I don't mean simply diversified, but to be British now is being illegalised. It's being illegalised and soon it's going to be criminalised as well. You can actually be arrested for flying an English flag. You can be, just this week I saw, we are still a Christian culture, if we're not a religious, necessarily a very religious society, we're definitely a Protestant religious culture. Some street preacher who had a quote from the Bible saying, God so loved his son that he sacrificed him to save mankind. And he was told by the police that this could be interpreted as a form of hate speech. This is a new thing. We've had hate speech for a long time. If anyone in the UK informs the police that they feel anxious or threatened, simply anxious, by anything that you or I say in public or online, the police will come to us or can come to us. They can knock on our door or they can come up to us in the street. And without telling us what exactly it is that we've said or who made the complaint, can arrest us or threaten us at least with arrest. They'll usually give us a warning that if we desist from speaking like this or we remove a post or whatever, a social media post, that they will arrest us on the grounds that it's hate speech. What has gone beyond that very recently now, if you watch what's going on in the UK, there's a new use of what is called public order arrests. If someone marches along a street, there's a lot of marches in England, the UK in particular, England in particular has marches every week. If in the middle of a pro-Palestinian protest, for instance, against what's going on in Gaza, what's been going on in Gaza for a long time. If an Englishman walks through with a Union Jack, he will be arrested on the grounds that it could cause a public disorder. Now, on the grounds of that, you might think, well, there might be some justification for that, but it's gone way beyond that now. If someone gets up with a British flag or, God forbid, an English flag in a public space in the UK, they will be told that it's a threat to public order, and therefore they will be threatened, you have to remove it or you'll be arrested. One of the more dangerous mutations of that, I'm sorry, I'm slightly going off culture, but I'm going to come back to it, is that the more violent the reaction to this display of anything which you might call cultural nationalism or British identity or English identity. So if someone suddenly attacks me and says that you're a right-wing racist and fascist, and these are words which are thrown around very commonly by woke for displaying an English flag or a British flag, that is now used by the police as justification for arresting you because you're clearly creating a public disorder. So the more intolerant and aggressive and violent the protesters against my rights to freedom of expression, as protected by the Human Rights Law 1998 and the European Commission on the Human Rights, the more violent they threaten me or actually attack me, the more proof there is that I am therefore guilty of creating a public disorder. So your listeners, in South Africa, I don't know, it's a pretty crazy place itself. This may sound like insanity. This, in a way, is what I'm trying to understand. How is it that the culture industry of the UK, which after all is peopled not only by artists, but by gallery owners, curators, the huge network of people who make the culture industry out of art, how is it that they have not only not opposed this, but have actually accommodated, and have turned these spaces of thought and debate and expression into places in which this clear insanity, which goes against everything that you could call European civilization or British culture or any other history and so on, how have these places become vehicles for the dissemination of a dogma and an ideology that is woke, that goes against everything that we understand, not just you and I, not just our generation, but that goes back for, I would say, 1,000 years of European civilization? The reason that they're doing that is because once you've eradicated these values, these principles, these understandings of how we live together, that I've got a right. I may not agree with someone getting up and flying a flag, but they shouldn't be arrested for doing so. If they shout out something which I find offensive, I might go up to them if I want and say, I disagree with you and this is why. But that, all that's gone now. Now it's simply arrest. That is a police state. And I would say it's a fascist state. It's probably the wrong word because woke is a fascist ideology. It shares a lot of fascism. It doesn't debate. It believes in censorship and it believes in violence as well. How has that happened? Now, I think the reason it's happened, I know we discussed how it's happened. The reason it's happened is, I think, because the end game, the immediate end game over the next 2050, by 2050, by 2070 at the very latest, is the replacement of the European people in the European continent, in the EU, if you like, and including the UK. Not the absolute replacement of those people, but the... Because the people become conquered way before they become a minority in their own country. You can see that, for instance, in Palestine. Or Israel, even though the Israelis there have been a minority up until fairly recent. I think it's still kind of a balance. They've run the country for a very long time before that. And I think what's happening to the happening across Europe, not just in the UK, though we're definitely at the forefront of it now, is that the civil service of the UK, and I think across Europe, the educational sector, the political sector, the cultural sector, definitely, the kind of the professional class, the administrative class who run the country, is being entirely replaced, or has been entirely replaced, by acolytes in the Church of Woke, this extremely intolerant ideology which wants to basically change UK and make it no longer a British society. So that's the role I think the art is playing at the moment. We can only do
blend,
such
by the way.
Yes, it is the colloquy. It is that. Mm. It is a form of, it's a unique form of colonialism. Colonialism in the past, the great years of colonialism, if you like, a lot of it instigated by the British Empire, of course, was you go into a country, you take over its control. And, you know, in the case of India, the Raj, as it was called, it wasn't a billion people then, but it was about 500 million, wasn't it? It was still an enormous population. It was run by about 5,000 civil servants. But they didn't replace the population. What's going on now in Europe and to an extent in the US, in Australasia as well, in Australia and New Zealand, is the native populations are being replaced by people from deeply incompatible cultures and backgrounds and ideas about how we live together, cultural backgrounds, ideological backgrounds, religious backgrounds, and so on and so forth. And I think we can only do that if, I can see it's being done, if you take away the cultural infrastructure, if you like, by which a British people are bound together. There's a belief, which is one of the principles of woke, that as soon as someone comes into a country, they become a nationality of that country. I find it very amusing. You know, I've got friends here in China who've lived here for about 18 years. Both their children are born and grew up here. They both speak Mandarin. But if anyone called them Chinese, they think they were mad. but in the UK, everyone who enters the UK, as soon as they get their citizenship or even before that, they suddenly become British. Now, I think the basis of that, again, this is a lunacy. It's not racism to say otherwise. It's you know, cultures are essentially national in their origins. And beyond that, they're regional in their expressions. Multiculturalism was about the erasure of those national boundaries, I think, and that was seen as a good thing. But the idea that as soon as someone steps into a country, no matter where they come from, they therefore become British or whatever. They can have citizenship, that's very different. Woke kind of collapses the difference between citizenship and a nationality. That, I think, is a very... That's a fundamental precept or principle of replacement immigration. I happen to think, you know, European civilization is possibly, it's one of the greatest civilizations there's ever been. The modern world doesn't exist without it. Yes, it has lots of faults. All great civilizations did. Roman did. You know, there's all sorts of great moments in different civilizations. Whether it is great or not, or one of the greatest, it comes out of the languages, the national cultures, the beliefs, the values, the interactions, which has often been very bloody, and all the things that make European people European, which is different from African peoples or Muslim peoples or, you know, all over, or Chinese peoples or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. We're nothing like what we used to be. We're shadows of our former selves, but that's what European culture is. If you replace the people of Europe with people from very, very different cultural backgrounds, that civilization will die. So Europe isn't a security apparatus. It is not a continent. It is not an idea. It is the people who occupy that place. And if you want to replace those people, you have to destroy their culture. And I think that's what's been going on.
Just to add to something you mentioned earlier about the British, I'm a result of the British, you know, coming to this southern tip of Africa. And I'm not British, but my ancestors obviously are. And I can tell you right now that South Africa, quote unquote, the Rainbow Nation, is a complete disaster. It cannot work. It doesn't work. It's a failure. Multiculturalism, when it's imposed, just does not work. It creates more conflict than anything else.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, multiculturalism was a product of neoliberalism, wasn't it? It was a lot of things, but it was first and foremost about the movement of labor, that is people, and the movement of money, finances, around the world. Without those bubbles of money and those people being subject to the employment laws or the taxes or the transparency laws of individual countries, it was about the attack on the nation state. You know, I think a lot of what's been happening in culture and therefore in art over the last 50 years, it's been about the dismantling of the nation state, which we've talked about elsewhere. And when you have dismantled the nation state, people no longer have a nationality. They no longer have any bonds to each other. Like it or not, and the woke don't like it, people like to be amongst their own. It's a very natural thing. You know, I live in a place in Hong Kong where I'm very, very rare here. You know, there's very few Westerners left here, unless you sort of go into Central and you go to the financial district. And they like living with each other. And they kind of look at me like saying, what are you doing here? And I wonder the same question. If they asked me, I'd say, because I no longer have a country. I can't live in Britain anymore. It's not, I don't feel safe there. I'd worry that I'd get arrested or my girlfriend would be raped by someone. It's a very, very dangerous country. But more than that, I don't feel any affinity with the people there anymore. Maybe if I went off into the country and so on. So it's no longer my country. And I think depriving people of their country, of their sense of belonging to their fellow man, of their ability to create communities, and above all, I think, maybe not above all, but very importantly, to pass down the values they got from their parents to their children, and to have a continuity of their mores, of their cultures, of their beliefs, of their values, even if they're religions, whatever it is that makes up a culture, that all gets destroyed. And that leaves us, as individuals, absolutely exposed to the people with the power over the culture industry, the media, our politics, our laws, and so on and so forth. So, yes, that's the bigger picture, if you like, of, I think, why, starting with an observation of why is there no more art anymore in the way that you and I understand it, it's actually part of a far bigger movement in which we are being left defenseless against the apparatuses of the state and the private sector behind it, if you like.
At the beginning of our conversation, I asked, what is art? But perhaps a better way to end the conversation is to ask the question, what was art?
What was art? At the end of my, I don't know if you read the preface, but I came up with that, I called it The Piper and the Archer. And it goes back to the, the way I know it, it's an old legend about the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Place in Germany where they have an infestation of rats in the town. The piper comes in. This is just remind your viewers if they don't know, your listeners. And the piper says, it's okay, I can pipe and chase, the rats will follow me and I'll rid you of this plague. And they all get together and say, great, wonderful, we'll pay you 500 guilders. He takes the rats away, and when he comes back and asks for it, they go, ooh, I'll give you 50. And they go back on their promises. So the piper looks at them and says, okay, and he does his pipe and he takes the children away instead. It's actually a legend, a myth, if you like, that goes back to the Middle Ages. And I think artists like to see themselves as the piper. That is, someone who has magical powers, but who is critical and punishes the state when it doesn't honour its allegiance, its role, doesn't honour its promises to society. You've rid us of the rats. Oh, no, you're not going to pay us. Unfortunately, I think for some time now, artists have, that's what art was. It helps keep, it's one of the checks and balances on the people in power not honouring their promises to the community and the society, whether that's a town or a whole country. Now they've become pipers for the state. Now they lead our children into the river of woke. They lead them to putting on masks. They lead them to injecting themselves against a disease which they are absolutely, almost entirely immune to. They lead our children into telling them that they're born in the wrong body or that they should mutilate themselves. Artists have become voice pieces, mouthpieces of the state instead of the defenders of the people against it. And I think that's a fundamental change about what art was or has been for a long time to what it's become now.
All right, Simon, how can my audience follow you?
You can follow me probably best on Twitter, or X as it's called now. I'm at Simon Elmer 2022. And if you'd like to buy a copy of my book, let me plug this, because called Culture Wars. Strangely, Amazon.co.uk, the UK version of Amazon, will not distribute my book now, which is never done with any of my other books. I'm trying to resolve that at the moment. You can get it on .com, the US version, or if you go onto my Twitter account, my X account, at Simon Elmer 2022, it will lead you to my website, and you can buy it off that. Please do.
Simon Elmer, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeremy. Good to talk to you.